My take right now is that strengthen the survivor, strengthen the victim. If they're able to speak to themselves, even 100 Angelina Jolies cannot sanitize this process at all. And the solutions will come from them.
This is the Radicals and Revolutionaries Lab. I'm Jillian Foster. This is the show that asks, what does feminism even look like? What do these power bitches do? Where do these provocateurs come from? And how can we get more of that glow? Join us as we dive into feminist awakenings and work that refuses to obey the rules.
My name is Jackie Mutere. I'm a survivor and I love life.
So tell me about your work. Why don't you give me a little bit of background on what type of work that you do, how you spend your time?
I started an organization called Grace Agenda that was really a response to the women that had been violated during our post-election violence in 2007, 2008. And it was an initiative born from my personal experience where I had been violated, and from the violation, it was a sexual violation. And I had gotten a baby from the rapes, and thereafter I had the baby, and in between there was three attempts for an abortion that backfired, and I eventually had the baby. But 1 week later, because of the sepsis that I had developed a very bad infection, and I had to come back into hospital. And then I lived in hospital for 3 months because I had gotten acute sepsis.
Oh my gosh, this sounds so intense.
Yeah, well, what do you do? That's what life is. Life is intense. Mm. I recovered after the operations and I left. And the business of living was working through my pain and working through the trauma that I had experienced. And because of that, I met with a lot of women that had been traumatized, just like myself. I decided just to, as an initiative, what better way it was with for engaging with other people, with other stakeholders, than forming a community-based organization, because that would be a more structured way. So that's what I do on a daily basis. My normal day would be to wake up, connect with myself, connect with my creator, plan for the day, go through what I need to do for the day, then plan my day. And then, of course, when the cock crows, by cock, I mean the children.
That's so funny.
Yeah, because that's when my day begins, when they get up.
How old are your children?
Okay, the smallest one is this little girl, Jasmine, princess. She's going to be 11. She calls herself 10. When she wakes up, "Mom, what's for breakfast?" That's when my day begins. And so I get up, and the next one is her older brother, just slightly older, just a year older. He's 12. Yes, he's 12. Please don't be shocked. Because of my age, at times I forget how many children I have.
Well, I mean, you have 5. That's a lot of children.
They are, yeah. The big ones are big.
Okay.
Yeah, there's the first one. She's in uni, finishing uni and working at the same time.
Okay.
The second one is also in uni. Allow me to brag a little bit. The first one is she finished undergrad in forensic investigation.
Oh, very interesting.
Forensic investigation. And so now she's majoring in criminology.
Oh, she's doing a second degree.
Yeah, in criminology. And the second girl is doing law, and she wants to do human rights law. I thought it was going to be...
Oh, community. Your children are lovely,
so
huh?
I like to think that I influence them positively.
I think so.
And then the third one is a boy who's just finished his exam and still trying, he's finding himself. That's his sort of type. Still going through the moody teen age. Talk to mom, don't talk to mom. I want money, I don't want money. Basically, that's my life. And then the two small ones. So my day begins with them. So the big ones have gotten their lives together. They go to college, go to work, come back. It's the small ones that my life is run around them. And so when they get off to school, then I sit down and I remember, yes, I have got to respond to email. Yes, I have got to write this proposal. Yes. And then suddenly I remember, oh my goodness, I don't have potatoes. I don't have food in the house. And then I said, no, I'll do that another day. And then I remember I've got to do laundry. And I said, no, work on the proposal. I don't know if there's anybody else who is different or same to me. It's what I should be doing. It's writing the proposals, responding to emails, doing all the tactical stuff that a normal CBO, head of office and founder would be doing, and thinking of connections and connecting and reconnecting and catching up. What I am doing is watching TV.
Yeah, sometimes it's overwhelming, right?
It is. And I've come to the age where I've learned for myself that when I hit brain drain, just stop.
Yeah.
Stop first, reconnect with yourself, and then thereafter you'll be more energized, more rejuvenated, more focused on what needs to be done. And so also for just for accountability and for good flow, I write down a lot of the stuff that I, so when I see that I haven't, and I tick the boxes. Mm. So when I find that I haven't done it, then I say, oh yes, this needs to be done. And then I get it done. And that's, if I get through two tasks a day, praise the Lord, I can sleep easy.
That's a really, I like that. I tend to make a really long list and then just feel constantly bad because I could never finish the list.
Absolutely.
It's so long.
You're being too hard on yourself.
Thank you. Yes.
You're being too hard on yourself. If you get two done, that's good enough.
Mm,
probably okay. The person that you need to respond to is going through exactly the same thing. Do you ever wonder why your very intense emails never get responded to after 2 days and you're wondering, I spent so much time thinking about what I'm writing to this person and they haven't responded? It's because they're probably going through what you're going through.
It's true.
Yeah.
It's true.
So don't be too hard on yourself. You're only human.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So let's talk about where you grew up. Where were you born?
I was born in Nairobi here.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I was born in Nairobi in a place called South B. In post-colonial times, the whites, the British had gotten certain areas. Mm-hmm. So there was this southern part. It was actually the southern part of Nairobi. So there was South B and there was South C. And those have grown up, had mushroomed. And those were, for all intents and purposes, middle upper class. Or maybe middle, let me just call it the middle class.
Colonialism was done by then? Or it was still
It was post-independence. It was 1967.
Okay.
Yeah, our independence was 1963.
Okay.
But and very much still it was still British-oriented. Okay. And so that's where I grew up. I had a good childhood, I must say. We lived in that neighborhood and then later on moved to a bit more plusher neighborhood. But then we hit some headwinds when my dad lost his job. And then my mom had to support us for a very long time. And so I grew up, I had a good education. I must thank my parents for that. I had good education, good background, and hence I'm able to articulate quite well about all these issues. But I found myself a very a fun-loving person. I enjoy laughing. I enjoy laughter. I enjoy telly. I'm a very theatrical person. And so I enjoy TV. I enjoy telly a lot. And I enjoy food.
Yeah.
And I've come to the age where I just want to live my life to the fullest because you only have one. You find people, so many of your friends and colleagues are dropping. And by dropping, I literally mean dropping because of cancer and illnesses and accidents and life, basically. And so I just value each and every day that I come, that I get.
You mentioned in the morning you like to reconnect with yourself and your creator. What do you do to reconnect?
I just get still.
Okay,
so I'm a Christian. Mm-hmm. And so I just get still and reconnect to God. First of all, I talk to myself and I find out what has been bothering me and if I have baggage. Do you know what happens is usually when you've got baggage within your system, it kind of comes out in very many different ways. You'll find yourself either overeating because you keep thinking about this thing and it's bothering you and you're not processing it. So I think it's my process time. So I really like to find, for example, if somebody upset me, or if I have a bad relationship with somebody or with something or in a situation and I haven't resolved it. Mm-hmm. So that bothers me a lot. I used to find that I'm eating a lot because I'm thinking about it, but I've not resolved it. And I find I'm just utilizing energy, you know, and I just keep snacking. That's the time when I just sit down and think, what is it that actually upset me? Was it the words that they spoke? Was it the attitude that they had towards me? And what can I do about it? Do I get up and start a boxing match? No, that's not really useful. Do I respond to them negatively? No. Was it their fault? And so I reflect and think about what I can do and what I cannot do. Mm-hmm. And what I cannot do, I just let it go. Mm-hmm. And what I can do, I do purpose. So I say to myself, okay, if this cannot be resolved through a normal discussion, let's find a mediator and let's sort this out. If it doesn't go beyond that, I'll just let it go. And I think that way you give your body less negative energy and you're able to focus more positively. And so that's how I reconnect with myself. And then I think about, now what do I want to have for breakfast?
Sounds nice.
Yeah.
Where did you learn that practice? Was that something that you did as a child?
No, I developed it actually because of the trauma that I had gone through. You know, you can go through a normal counseling, psychological process. But if you don't really work the pain yourself, you're just giving them a job.
Mm-hmm.
But you really haven't. You could have gone through six sessions. And ideally speaking, the minimum number of sessions any counselor you're supposed to go through is about six sessions. That's the minimum.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully, usefully, 10 sessions. And by then, you should have processed your pain. But it doesn't work like that because you've got different personalities. And so when I was in hospital, just after I had the baby, like I shared with you, I had plenty of time to myself. I had the hospital walls since I was isolated because I had an acute infection and they didn't want to mix me with other patients in the ward. And so I had this room and I really needed a lot of rest. And so during the time of recovery is when I was also reconnected with myself and wondering, if I do make it, what do I want to do in life? If I don't make it, what should I do? And so you get to a point where you really want to straighten yourself out and straighten things out. And during that time of reflection is where you develop that practice of reconnecting with yourself first. And you're of more value to others when you first of all value yourself.
That's lovely. I completely agree.
Yeah.
It's a hard practice to do.
Absolutely. It's very hard. It's over time. We're talking 10 years now mm-hmm. is when I do sleep a lot of times and I find myself woken up when the alarm goes off. Remember the cock crowing?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. You can slip up so easily, but then when you find yourself, you can't write emails, you're not cognitive enough, you're easily irritable, you're easily irritated, you need to reconnect with yourself.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
And it's different things for different people, Jillian. You could have maybe some people just like, you know, for example, I like green.
Like the color green.
The color green, serenity, water flowing, peace pictures, peaceful pictures. That kind of thing rejuvenates me. Or just bumming in front of the TV and watching comedies. That revives me because I'm a happy person and I connect with happiness. And so it's different things to different people.
So what was your family like when you grew up? How many siblings did you have? And what was the home life like?
Oh, wow. Now, I am the firstborn of 11 children.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
They say firstborns are like very leader material, and you seem like you're very leader material.
I don't know if that's a default position. Yeah. Perhaps some of it is default, some of it is personality. Some things you acquire over time, of course, mm-hmm. because you just have a natural tendency to be responsible for the others because they're smaller than you mm-hmm. somehow. And so you just feel a natural protection over them. But then when you get to be 40 and 40 plus and heading towards 50 and you're still protecting them, there's a problem there. Mm-hmm. But I grew up in a family of 11 children. I had my mom, my father had two wives. It's a polygamous family. And we had the big family where I come from and then the smaller family.
So the 11 children were between the both moms?
Between the both moms. Okay. My mom had seven. Okay. The other mom had four.
What was it like growing up in a polygamous family? I asked that because I used to be a part of a religion that had a breakoff group. Mm-hmm. I wasn't part of the breakoff group, mm-hmm. but the breakoff group mm-hmm. Practices polygamy. Mm-hmm. And I have kind of mixed feelings on it. I can't quite figure out how I feel sometimes.
There's so many dynamics, Jillian, when it comes to polygamous relationships. There's so many dynamics. At times the children hate themselves, they hate each other. At times they love each other. At times the mothers collude to tick off the man. And your boy, and at times you're caught in the middle. And as the firstborn, at times you see the trauma of your mother mm-hmm. enduring pain because of seeing the attention your dad is giving to the other mother. Mm-hmm. At times you see the pain of my father became a drunkard because he had lost his job and he had these two women and didn't have an income and he needed to maintain them. And so what is he going to do? And so seeing the pain of my mom struggling through all those years, it was extremely difficult. And then at times when the other family is favored over you, it becomes very, very painful.
Did you all live in one big house or
yes.
houses near one another?
No, one big house.
Oh, really?
One okay. big house, but it was divided in two. But duplicate houses, mm-hmm. the other family had their own house similar to ours. We had ours. We, the big children, were responsible very naturally for the small children,
right.
just by default. But it has its dynamics. But in retrospect, as we have grown up now, we love each other. We sincerely do love each other. And even when the mothers bring their dynamic intricacies and their bad blood between them, we tell them off. We tell them off in love, of course. You know, yeah. we just tell them, Mom, we're not going to go that direction. We need to do this thing together. Over the years, we have developed a wonderful, wonderful bond. The children all know each other. The aunts and uncles, we've got a chat group and we crack jokes over our school days and our youthful days. But there were some very difficult years in between there.
Okay.
Yeah, and because of polygamy, you know, eventually we had to separate at some point. Yeah, because Dad had to make his choice.
And, oh, really? Yeah. Like legally or financially?
No,
or?
Financially. He just made a choice because he couldn't. And the other, the small mom wanted her independence and her freedom. She wanted her own house because all this time we had been living together. So she separated. And when we separated, my mom was bereft with the pain and the grief and the neglect and the loneliness and the rejection. You know what woman rejection really does something to your self-esteem, and you develop other problems related to that. It becomes really challenging. In between that, then I got married.
So your father stayed with your mother, or your father went with the other woman?
My father went with the other woman.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
So then your mother supported all of the seven children?
The seven children. And so it was very difficult, very, very difficult. And so I usually think of myself as a sacrificial lamb, because now resources that could have been put to what I would have wanted now had to stop, and now had to build the other children.
Right.
And so I quickly got into the workplace and started helping my mom to support the children, go through school, and eventually now go through college. And here I am.
What did you study in college?
I studied nursing.
Oh, that's a good degree.
Yeah, but then I didn't finish. I don't know. I just went wayward, I think, because of the trauma. I just wanted to find myself. I didn't finish. I didn't graduate, but I did the nursing course, but I didn't graduate. I just left. One day I just woke up and left. And so these are things that I'm thinking about and reflecting. I'm wondering, should I complete it right now and actually just go and graduate? And I'm wondering, would it add value? Or would my knowledge in the work that I'm doing now just add value to the work that I'm doing now? And I think that's the best way. And that's what I'm doing right now. Because one of the skills that I have, one is naturally occurring and one is through training, is observation. And so when dealing with survivors of rape, at times, there's a lot of unspoken, body language.
Yeah.
And when at times somebody can't put some things into words, they would rather just, they'd fiddle with their fingers or not look you in the eye or turn away or sigh deeply or slouch when they're talking to you. That tells you something. And so I think some of the skills that I learned during my training actually have helped me. And, also in just treating minor cuts and bruises. And one time there was an emergency in a place where we lived. And there's a lady who was a young girl, a teenage pregnancy girl. She went into labor. She had not told anybody. She told her mother. She had gone where she had gone, gotten the baby, and then she came back just before she gave birth.
Oh, wow.
And so I just kept seeing people in the family running into the house and running out, and wondering what's going on. And then I said, so what's the problem? And they said, so-and-so is having a baby and she can't go to hospital. I said, are you people serious? And when I went, she was ready and writhing and jumping and she couldn't. And I just thought to myself, okay, so the her brother asked, so what do I do? I said, first of all, go get gloves, go get a razor blade, go put on hot water. Have you ever wondered what the hot water is for?
I assume to sterilize.
Cup of coffee afterwards.
Yeah. Everyone will need that.
Yeah. But I think it's also just for the cleanup, cleanup afterwards. Not for anything, but for a cup of coffee for me. And so because of my knowledge and skills in obstetrics and in midwifery,
yeah.
I was able to help the young girl to have the baby properly.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah. Things, for example, like she was a young girl and her stomach was really tight and she couldn't push and the head was getting stuck. Mm. And then eventually the head came out, and then I thought to myself, the baby looks blue.
Yeah.
So I recognized that the cord was around the neck. And so I was able to actually maneuver just before she pushed the baby out to remove the cord around the neck.
Amazing.
Yeah. So I learned skills.
Yeah, definitely.
Become useful. So, and I graduated in my own sight.
Yes. Yes. In practice as well. You put these skills to practice.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I was able to help her now. And also wait for the placenta to come out.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And to count. You know, there's a way in which the placenta is supposed to be full. It's sort of has got globs, for clots, for lack of a better word, some connections. And if one connection has broken, that means it's retained in the uterus. And that's usually a major cause of bleeding.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
And
okay.
So you're supposed to actually check that all of them have that the placenta has come out completely.
That makes sense. Yeah. Because if it stays in you,
if it stays inside,
it'll
just keep bleeding.
Ooh.
And it causes infection. And that's how a lot of women, that's why there's sort of so many maternal deaths
I did not know that. Wow, that makes complete sense, though.
Yeah. So I was able to use my skill and a bit of that, my knowledge to help that. And then thereafter, I just told her, okay, now, girl, after this, take a bath, put your legs together, and sit in warm, salty water. That's what the hot water is for.
Yeah.
clean yourself up and then just make sure that you go to the clinic so you can get stitched because you've gotten a bit of a tear during the delivery. And, you know, when it's an unskilled birth, usually the tear goes straight down the perineum, which is very dangerous because if it reaches the anus, it's very difficult to heal.
That's when you can get a fistula?
Absolutely. But a normal process of an episiotomy, they would cut through the side and create space and it's much easier to stitch there. And it heals much faster. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I was able to put my skills to good use.
So when you said you got married, did you get married in college or after?
No. Just afterwards.
Okay.
Afterwards. And then I just went into the job market because I had to support my mother. Because each time I was in college, she'd, you know, phone calls, this is happening. She's calling me, she's crying, she's doing this, she can't manage. And I thought to myself, it's not helping me. I'm not doing exams properly. I'm not thinking straight. Let me just go back home and help her out. That was it. And so those are one of the deciding factors on what helped to influence me to leave college.
Mm.
Yeah.
So how old were you when you got married?
I was 23 when I was pregnant. Let me come up straight.
Yeah. To clarify. Okay, so you were 23 with your first child.
I was 23 with my first child. After 5 years, I got my second child.
Mm-hmm.
And then my third child, I got at 33. And then after that, we had a solemnization exercise. We just went to church.
A church wedding type of thing?
No, it wasn't a wedding.
Oh.
it was just a legal procedure.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it was done at the church venue.
I see. Okay.
Yeah, so there were two witnesses. The pastor was there. Will you be faithful? Yes. Are you being forced? No. Will you stay with her? Yes. Do you pledge obedience and allegiance and all the good things? He said yes. I said yes. I do. And that's it. We got our certificate, walked out of there, went to have lunch and went back home.
Is this normally how it's done in Kenya?
No.
Yeah, I was going to say, this seems unusual.
No, that was very unusual. I just wanted to put things right for posterity also. And I just needed it for myself. You know, it's amazing, Jillian, what happened? Thereafter, my husband fell sick.
Oh.
After about a year, he developed meningitis.
Oh my gosh, that's terrible.
He died.
Oh my goodness, that's so terrible.
Yeah, so stuff happens in life.
Yeah.
Stuff happens in life. And so this is because of the trauma of having to bury him and bringing up three small children on my own at such a young age.
Mm-hmm.
I think perhaps the process of learning how to deal with pain, I learned it also after when I went through now the violation and was able to manage my pain much, much better then and able to process the pain. And you know, when people don't know how to process pain, you'll always be thinking of, first of all, of yourself as the victim, and you'll always be blaming others for your pain. And that's not normally the cause and the reason. But when you find and discover yourself, the reason and the cause for the pain, you're able to process it much better and become a much better human being. Mm. And you'll be also good to yourself. Mm. Yeah.
That's amazing. So your husband passed away.
Yeah.
And then
bringing up the children.
You were bringing up the children. What kind of work were you doing at that time?
Community mobilization.
Oh, okay.
I also did a correspondent course on community organizing.
Okay.
And so I was organizing communities, helping them fulfill their own visions, helping groups to establish themselves, bringing women together, talking, being a motivational speaker.
This is like so what you're good at. This is exactly you.
It seems to be. So I just thought, this is what I'm good at and this is what comes to me easily and naturally.
Yeah.
So let me utilize that. And I have fun doing it. And I like engaging with people, interacting with people. And since it occurred naturally, I said, let's make money from it. So it's a good thing.
Yeah.
And so that's what I was doing all that time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then you were working, doing that. And then you eventually started Grace Agenda. And it seems like you've kind of enveloped some of those skills into Grace Agenda because you are very outspoken about sexual violence and conflict.
Yep.
And your work at Grace Agenda.
Yep.
Have you ever had points where you just wanted to quit? You said it's just too much.
So many. I would be alive. I told you that I wouldn't think of quitting. And most of the time when I know that I'm about to quit is when I just can't, when you can't get out of bed. And you ask yourself, is it really worth it? Who is this for anyway? Because you're thinking the benefits vis-a-vis the effort, it's not balancing. Mm-hmm. And then a lady will call you and tell you, Jacqueline, remember you had told me that you're supposed to be seeing the Attorney General over our issue of reparations? Where have you reached? I haven't woken up well today. My back is aching. I came back from hospital yesterday and my infection is still disturbing me. I was just wondering if I could have been helped by some medical care. I really would have appreciated. Mm-hmm. I think to myself, my goodness, she can't speak. First of all, she's out of town. She's out of Nairobi. She can't get the Attorney General. She's unable to write a letter to the Attorney General. And I'm right here. And I'm sitting here feeling sorry for myself, out of bed, girl. And those are the things that motivate me to keep going. Mm-hmm. But there were times when I really do get even mentally tired. I usually take the route I've told you. Get myself a pizza and and a big bottle of Coke and just black out on the sofa with the duvet and resurface when I need to eat.
Yeah.
And go back and go to the ladies' room. And you just get yourself your energy back. You get your energy back step by step.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also sharing with the women that you at times that you've been being honest. With the women that you work with and telling them that I really haven't worked on that thing that I had told you. It has delayed a little bit, perhaps not on my side, but I really will get back to you. And please just give me time. I'll get back to you until you get in yourself. Because you have no value to them if you don't have the energy to do the work.
Right, if you're kind of halfway doing it.
Absolutely. And then also what helps me is when you go for international meetings and with other people and do lessons learned and share experiences, you're also revitalized and re-energized and you get to eat good food.
It's true.
Yeah. And you know what? Hotel food, what I love about hotels, somebody else does the cooking.
I know.
Yeah.
I really like going out to eat for that reason too. Absolutely. It's like such a treat.
It is a treat. It's a treat to yourself. And just at times being with yourself. And at times women think that if you just sit and have a meal yourself, the children will die. They won't die. Even if you died, they would live.
That is the truth.
Yeah, they really would live. And I don't mean that in any way to undignify anything. Mm-hmm. But sincerely, you just need to give back to yourself. So I get myself a big chocolate cake with plenty of cheese icing and just savor it with a book and then go and take in a movie and just sleep or maybe go on YouTube and listen to a lot of junky stuff, you know, stuff like Gogglebox or listen to Eddie Murphy
Eddie Murphy's so funny.
Yeah, he really is so funny. The old kind of comedy, not Kevin Hart kind of comedy. I really don't appreciate that. No. Maybe it's my age also, you know. I like old school comedy.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. And just reconnect with yourself. Some of these international meets are good. Going through an airport and just sitting and appreciating where you are. Being in the air flying is an experience.
Oh, definitely.
You know, I still get fascinated. How do you sit in a ton, something that weighs over a ton, and it's suspended in the air?
I know, it's crazy. I just flew this morning.
Did you really?
Yeah, I flew from Addis to Nairobi. Yeah.
Oh my goodness, yeah. Jillian. And you're going to the toilet in the air?
Yeah.
And you're watching movies in the air?
I'm always afraid that when I'm in the toilet.
Yeah, something might happen.
And then I'm like, oh no, they're going to see me. I'm in the toilet.
Those kind of experiences help show you how finite you are. And also that there are other things to life. You know, there's air level and there's ground level. Mm-hmm. And that while you're still in the air, enjoy the experience.
Yes. Okay. I have a bit of like kind of a sticky question. Mm-hmm. I'm curious how you think that we should address sexual violence. For me, I really get sick of a lot of attention being placed on, that sounds bad. I don't get sick of it. I want a lot of attention and money spent on survivors. Mm-hmm. I do. But what I feel like happens is there's this conversation around survivors changing, survivors being empowered, and there's not a lot of attention on men. And men as perpetrators in particular. And so it's almost like they get away without having to change. And it feels like a lot of the work is done by, on women, you know, done by women, on women changing. And it just, it feels like an added burden. I don't know if I'm maybe just a bit crazy or if you...
It's a perspective.
Yeah.
And I respect your perspective because your perspective comes from an experience. So you must have experienced something. You really are, for lack of a better word, sick of it because the burden is placed on you, the survivor. And I really do appreciate that.
Right.
Yeah. that being the reason is simply because perhaps it's the women alone or women themselves who have been through the pain, and maybe the people who are able to speak about it are women, and because they're the ones who are violated more, and because men don't speak about more. And I appreciate when you say that the men as perpetrators, there isn't much burden for them to change and to change things and to do things, because there's not really been a focus on them, because the focus is on the woman, on the violation of the woman, the long-term impact, the cost of it on the woman, on her life, on her extended family, on her children.
All of which is really important.
Yeah, that is true. But I appreciate that the focus actually should refocus also on the men as perpetrators, but I don't even know how to go about it.
I think this is the problem, that we don't know how to go about it, because it's so difficult, and it basically...
Absolutely.
It requires so many men to change.
Absolutely. And then which man have you ever heard confessing that I was a violator?
Exactly.
And that I have been through a process of rehabilitation, and here I am, I'm a good man now.
I used to work a long time ago at the beginning of my career. I worked briefly at a domestic violence shelter.
Absolutely.
So women would come there with their children and they would live there.
Yeah.
And many of them were survivors of sexual violence.
Yes.
And it was so much for these women and their children to bear, the displacement, trying to seek services. But there was this conversation around men as perpetrators. It's this saying of, you know, once a perpetrator, always a perpetrator.
Yeah.
And part of me agrees with that, but then the other part is kind of resentful that we're just kind of like, oh, he's a perpetrator.
Yeah,
that's
so
it.
Yeah.
So he doesn't have to do any work.
I think I share that frustration, because we shouldn't just write them off. We should hold them accountable.
Right.
I don't know how to hold them accountable, but I appreciate your frustration that the burden of proof, the burden of care, the burden of accountability should be on them too. The problem is, where will you get them?
I don't know.
You would get them from the prison system. But when you find, what I've come to find is when a perpetrator has gone in for rape, he'll go in for 3 years if he's been sentenced. 3 or years. I see. No, these days they're getting maximum sentences of 15 years, others for life. But then that's somebody who can't come out and talk about the rehabilitation and what he was and what he currently is now. And I find that the sexual violence is an accompaniment to another vice. Either it's in robbery, it's in a hijack, it's in militia, it's part of an initiation. So that sexual violence is part of something else. But you do have those deviant people, the deviant personalities, that would actually, the social deviants, who actually target children, pedophiles, actually just want to violate children for whatever sick reason that they think of. Maybe we should rechange the focus that it should be a parallel plan, that while we're working on the women on this side, that men on the other side should always, some action should be taken. But you need to get them first. And where are we going to get them? So I have come across a few organizations, but I'm yet to come across any that actually, for lack of a better word, exhibits any of the perpetrators who are reformed and who will be able to be champions of this cause.
Right. I mean, sometimes I wonder if part of the problem is that a lot of men don't see this as a problem. Like,
absolutely,
this is the way that men engage with women.
Absolutely.
In a worldwide culture, a worldwide system that devalues women.
Absolutely.
That it dehumanizes women.
Absolutely.
And then at the fringes of that, you have behavior of rape, sexual violence.
Absolutely.
Like,
absolutely.
It's so endemic. It's really an issue.
Absolutely. So, Jillian, it's I used to think that it was just in Africa that men violate women, men beat women. But when I look at all the conflict situations in this world, when I think about the Rohingya women, when I think about the war in Syria, when I think about the Yazidi girls, really, it's human nature. You go, I cannot explain. And perhaps maybe we should refocus, not really refocus, but perhaps as parallel to the women initiatives, have a parallel program for the male initiatives, and perhaps get answers from the survivors. What do you think needs to be done? So maybe we should start a research on engaging with them as perpetrators. Which direction should we take? Which kind of focus should we think of reforming them? Should we get them at the probation schools? What are they called? The Boston institutions?
Okay.
Should we get them at Boston institutions where they started behaving deviant? At which point do we get them to start reforming them? where do we get positive champions to actually speak out, you see, instead of that? So I think the onus should also be on the men themselves.
I think so.
In the name of protecting the women race, for lack of a better, for a better term, to actually start initiating some of these champions alone. I see that happening in the faith institutions. They're really trying, and kudos to them. But I want to see more. I really want to see more.
I think there's, it seems like people talk about a crisis of masculinity.
Absolutely.
Or men in crisis. And part of me, I kind of agree with that, but I don't think it's because of women. I think it's actually a system of, you know, basically dehumanizing men in a way as well, mm-hmm. where they become almost like distant from their natural state, which is, you know, like humans are, can be very loving and kind, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. but if they're brought through trauma, if they're told or taught to behave in terrible ways, mm-hmm. then it's like they get distant from that kind self.
Yeah.
And they
yeah.
become they like polluted in a way.
Yeah.
You know?
They dissociate from their natural occurring self,
right.
and acquire these other, the deviant behavior, which comes more naturally to them. I think, but that comes because of practice.
Yeah, definitely.
It becomes because of practice. So now, is it possible to help them practice differently? Practice more positive masculinity? But maybe we need more positive masculine images. Men who are seen and supporting the women. God bless Obama.
Love me, Obama.
Yeah. God bless His Royal Highness. Who's Meghan's husband? What's his name? Prince Harry?
Oh, Prince Harry, yeah.
Yeah, with his firstborn. You know, it would be so nice if we could get opinion, people who shape opinions. Like if we got Prince Charles, if we got Prince Harry, who the world seems to love currently right now, if we get men like Obama to speak out in some of these spaces where they are and make global things, it would really matter. When Angelina Jolie was she was an ambassador for sexual violence in conflict?
UN ambassador, something
ambassador,
like this.
Yes,
yeah, like special ambassador
absolutely.
For something.
And instead of sitting in conferences in the Hidden Highlands in some place in Europe, but be seen on the ground talking to these women, talking to women and men also, appealing to men to become champions, supporting male champions also, it would, I personally feel that it would have a very positive impact. But I let me just tell you, I was so offended when she came to Kenya. She went to the UN.
Really? What did she do? What?
She just came into the UN grounds where it was nice and shady, and there was a battery of reporters what are they called? The press.
Yeah.
And gave a very sanitized speech. And it was so lackluster. I was so disappointed. Yeah. And I thought to myself, is that a Hollywood star that is who knows her lines so well? She could have at least practiced something human to say. It sounded really, really trumped up.
This whole point of sanitizing is really frustrating.
Absolutely.
I think, like you've said before, sexual violence it's not a sexy topic. It's not a fun topic.
Absolutely.
It's really complex and difficult.
Absolutely.
And it kind of implicates many of us, all of us,
absolutely.
In this, right?
Absolutely.
And so I think we tend to want to round off the edges, maybe make it a bit...
Make it palatable.
Make it palatable.
Yeah.
But at its core, it is not a palatable thing.
It is a horror that needs to be dealt with.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it's so frustrating to see the sanitization going on.
Absolutely. And so what I think would bring sanity back to this madness is perhaps when survivors themselves speak out.
Oh, I could not agree more. Yes.
My take right now is that strengthen the survivor. Strengthen the victim. If they're able to speak to themselves, even 100 Angelina Jolies cannot sanitize this process at all. And the solutions will come from them. When your shoe is biting you, you know, they say the person who knows the shoe is the wearer. It's literally because the person who has gone through the experience knows where it hurts and is well able to tell you that it hurts here. And therefore I need medicine here. It's my back that's hurting. Give me my medication for my back. Not to tell a doctor that it's my back that's hurting. And then they put a bandage on your ankle. So let the survivor be empowered to speak, and let us develop champions also. And if we can get allies, because I know they are a few good men, not the movie, but
yes,
not the movie, but if we could get a few good men to stand up for women, a champion Some are developed, some are strengthened, some of them grow into it. Some of them are just by default. Let's encourage them and let's develop allies of men champions, male champions who are able to walk with us.
That's great. What do you think survivors want and need?
In the calls for reparations and what survivors really want, you need to bring the survivors on board for them to tell you what they want. So if a survivor tells you that they need education, it's because most likely her education was cut off at some point, and she need, and for value addition, and for her to be somebody or to advance in life, she wants education.
Her education was cut off because of the sexual violence.
Absolutely,
experience.
She was raped. She can't go to school again anymore. And let the reparation, let them be transformative. For example, if she cannot go back to school, the normal education system, and she feels that she wants to do some skills building course, some technical institution, let her do that. But don't say that because she's a woman, she has to go to a tailoring school.
Exactly.
If she feels that she wants to be an electrician, ensure that she goes to a technical institution that can give her the skills to be an electrician so that she can join the job market to be of value to herself and her child. Let them be transformative and engage with them at the table. Let it also not be like they're handing out a pittance. Let it not be pittance. You were raped. It ended. What happened? What else would you be complaining about? What do you want? Take this 40,000 and, you know, be on your way. Bring them on the table. They will bring solution. And justice means different things to different survivors. One survivor will want the compensation of money. Another survivor will want social security for a certain period, for a certain time, just for a bit of continuity. Basically, what the government ought to give is a basic NHIF card. That's a health card, so that you ensure that they get medical services when it is needed. The bare minimum, and you know, just the bare minimum, and then social security and medical care. And then the others would just be an additional plus. And for those with children from the rapes, education for both yourself and the child if you want, but also assurance that this child will get the support. Not just good measures and good speeches and initial checks being handed out in public, and then thereafter nothing happens, and then you find after 1 year, child out of school, money hasn't been dispersed to the institution, the education has stopped. And so others want the money in electronic form, go to the account. Others just want, give me my liquid cash now because I know I can't trust you to be able to continue with this. Give me my cash now and you won't hear from me anymore.
I just came from the DRC.
Okay.
Reparations came up so many times in the conversation as well. It's a huge issue.
Yeah.
This is very consistently what survivors want and need.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I wonder what that looks like. So when I think about reparations, I think it's a way of adding closure to a very traumatic experience.
And
it's ending the chapter.
Absolutely. It's ending the chapter. It's bringing closure. And it's also an acknowledgement that we feel your pain.
Right.
It's a form of acknowledgement. It really, really is. And you know, now that you mentioned DRC, Dennis Mukwege cannot go unmentioned in this conversation.
Yeah.
And he was thinking of an initiative.
Why don't you say who he is for people who might not know?
Okay, Dennis Mukwege is this doctor who fixes women's bodies within the DRC and recently won the Nobel Peace Prize together with the lady from Iraq. Nadia Murad and Dr. Dennis Mukwege for sexual violence, both of them for the initiatives and for their relentless work in supporting women who have been violated because of rape and the consequences and the impact of the same. He wanted, his take is on reparations also because he's seen the cost of the violation on the lives of the women, that even after fixing their bodies, they still need to live, they still need to eat, they've got other children, they've got other things. There's the immediate environment in which these survivors operate in their families and in their communities. His take was to have an initiative, but I wondered who would support that. You know, ideally speaking, reparations are supposed to be given through the government.
Part of me wonders if ideally, and this is very ideal, it would be straight from the perpetrator.
Absolutely.
Like you
Absolutely.
Did this,
through the normal
you
system,
pay.
Through like, the normal judiciary system, the perpetrator is supposed to pay. But when you have a perpetrator who is a police force, that's the state has to pay. Absolutely.
And in the DRC, it came up a lot. The perpetrators are poverty stricken themselves. They don't
Absolutely.
Have money.
Absolutely. And so they took advantage. They were just gangsters also taking advantage of the situation and just abusing the women. And so the state should be in a position to actually align that, because you see, the state, the government will, a healed survivor will add value even economically to a country. And a healed person is a better person also to deal with. You have less difficult consequences in the long term. And so the reparations fall on the state. And it's a way of acknowledging that this happened and that we want to include you in this conversation of how we can bring this thing to closure. And in turn, you will help us heal the nation. Because as I mentioned to you earlier, what happens to these children who have been born of rape if they live in very negative circumstances, in a negative environment, and the mothers have continued to plant negative seeds in them? They will turn into perpetrators. It's not unheard of. You know, we're talking about sexual violence and conflict, and we somehow come to a place in life where you're able to speak about it. But I know this is nothing new to humanity. If it has happened now, it has happened before.
So, absolutely.
So there must be so many women and so many children and so many people who have been born from rape. And I do not doubt in my mind, I have no doubt in my mind that many people that you find perpetrating actually were victims at some point. Either them or people that they know, and they're just giving back to society what they... Because life is about giving. You cannot take what you have not given or what you don't have. You give what you have. If you have pain, you will give pain. If you have joy, you will give joy. It's just a natural physical science. That's how it is.
Perfect. Thank you. Radicals and Revolutionaries Lab is a product of Continuum. Find me at Jillian J. Foster on all the socials, and Continuum at We Are Continuum, that's W-E, the letter R, Continuum, on Twitter, and Continuum Collective on Instagram. Our show is produced by Ginny Saraswati and her team at Ginny Media. Thanks to Sarah Letitia Jansen for research and production support. Want to contribute to the R&R Lab? Join the Continuum Collective. If you're not a Continuum Collective member, you're missing out on all sorts of perks like exclusive events, the gender studies course of your dreams, and bragging rights to all your podcast-loving friends to let them know that you're supporting the boundary-pushing work we do at Continuum, including this podcast right here. Go to ContinuumCollective.org to join today. That's ContinuumCollective.org. I'm Jillian Foster. Until next time, sending you power, love, and solidarity.